attention. It's kind of funny because one of the questions is so obvious here, we don't get a lot of it. But the question we want to know is, are three dimensions special? Certainly a lot of the work we've shown is consistent to have three-dimensional universes. That is to say, things can look three-dimensional. That's almost like space-time dimension, the same three dimensions, obviously. But the question is there any reason to think that? We're sort of putting it in a little bit by hand when we're finished with three grants, for example. And the question is this a natural calendar? So I don't want to dwell on this, but the context part, the fact that people are thinking about having multiple vacua as a possibility, but it's done in a sort of very narrow way. People think about the possibility that there could be different vacua in which we might live. But they actually focus on a very narrow subset of those. And so the question is, what is the full range of possibilities? And in fact, I think it's very likely that there are a lot of different possible vacua that we don't necessarily have some static principle like minimum energy that picks one out. However, I do get disturbed when people jump to that and sort of combine with the anthropic principle, because the anthropic principle is basically the statement that we don't have any good answer to a question, so we're going to be using the anthropic principle. So I think before we do that, we want to make sure that we really explore all the possibilities. And so far, people sort of concentrate on obviously compact five dimensions, and really even more strictly of some constraint of Clavio. I mean, a lot of speaking of insights lately have been that Clavio was in everything. Actually, I'm happy that aren't Clavio, which is not really a surprising thing. But there probably are a lot more as well. And I think in the context of localized gravity that I've been working on, it really is a completely different scenario. And it's funny because I was actually at a conference in December where I was talking to people thinking, where are the oranges? And I said, well, they're actually equivalent by duality to these to the various types of vacuum they were considering. So that's just not true. If it's a conformal theory, it's a broken conformal theory, it's just not closed. And these really are new types of vacuum that just have not been considered. So if you're trying to address cosmological questions or just trying to address physics questions in general, you want to make sure you're exploring the full range of possibilities. And I think there might be some qualitatively new insights that we can get by studying these different types of vacuum. In particular, what I want to focus on is something called the relaxation principle, which is just a very simple idea. It's just that maybe there aren't static principles that are determining which of the vacuum we live in, but maybe there's some sort of dynamical thing. In other words, it might not be that there's a minimum energy state, but maybe that's the only state that we evolve into. So even though it's not minimum energy, if it's where we're going to end up, it's the right state anyway, even if we don't have a good reason. If it's just evolution drives us, that is a good reason. And I'm just going to mention that Shinjimoto Kahama had tried to apply this to the cosmological concept. And it was sort of a fun idea. What we did was we said, suppose you had a field whose minimum, so its potential, it has a minimum negative energy. This is energy, this is BFI, and this is phi. And so suppose it had a minimum negative energy. Well, obviously we don't want to live in a negative energy universe. Well, what we had was a kinetic term that blew up when the energy got close to zero. So when the curvature was close to zero, the kinetic term blew up for the field. So what would happen in that case would be a scalar field would roll down, and it would try to roll towards the minimum, but when it got to zero energy or zero curvature, the kinetic term would blow up, but it would freeze. So the idea was to have the evolution freeze near where the cosmological constant was zero. And it worked in some respects. Unfortunately, it was just too slow. We couldn't find a model where this happened quickly enough that the instant expanded away. But it's sort of, it's at least illustrative of the kind of principle they might think might be at work. It would be nice to find a better implementation, but maybe the reason we are sitting in a universe of small cosmological constants is that the universe gets driven there and just freezes there, even though it's not some static principle like minimum energy that tells us that's the case. Okay. So that was the idea of that work. I'm not going to talk about that today, but I'm going to apply the same principle to the question of dimensionality and ask what the universe drives us towards. So the outline is to first briefly review localized gravity. Are there people here who are not familiar with localized gravity? Sure. I'll go through that briefly, but I do want to just mention a couple words about localized gravity, because I think it's sort of ignored and it could be kind of relevant for cosmology. It could be very relevant. I'm going to review old ideas for explaining three dimensions of space. And then I'll discuss the new idea that Andreas Karcher, which I've been working on for the last year. And and so explain why it might be relevant to three special dimensions. Okay. So the idea of localized gravity is that there's going to be a mode of the graviton in a higher dimensional space is going to be a mode of the graviton that gets localized. That is to say, a normalizable state that mediates lower dimensional gravity. Okay, that's the idea. In the particular case that I worked out with Ramit, had just the simple warp factor, the exponential warp factor. It's called the warp factor because it's multiplying the same metric. You just have a flat metric, but the overall scale factor depends on R. Okay. It depends on R if it's exponential, and so does the graviton wave function, which is why it's a normalizable state, and that's the essential idea. So that's what the wave function is doing. Okay. I just want to mention that we found another example. So in that case, we had a flat metric, right? It was even minus a kr times a to mu nu dx mu dx nu. Andreas and I actually went and studied a different example, which was based on an ABS frame. In that case, we had a flat frame, which is why we had the flat metric, a to mu nu dx mu dx nu. But we studied a case based on an ABS frame. Now, you might say, why do an ABS frame? We know we live in a Sitter space, if anything. We have a small positive cosmological constant, not a small negative cosmological constant. But the reason we studied that was we were actually perplexed. There was a perplexing result. The perplexing result was that if you looked at the warp factor in the case of ABS space, that the even minus kr is called the warp factor, the factor that's multiplying, essentially the conformal factor from the point of view of any given slice. If you looked at what happened with the conformal factor in this case, or the warp factor, it decreases exponentially first, but then it blows up. Now, as we take the ABS cosmological constant, that is to say the absolute value of the cosmological constant on the ABS frame smaller and smaller, where it blows up moves further and further away. So that agrees with the fact that you would expect to more closely resemble flat space as you decrease the magnitude of the cosmological constant and it becomes a flat frame. But the mysterious thing was that no matter what, it went ahead and blew up, which means no matter how small that cosmological constant is, you lose this normalizable zero mode. Okay? No matter what, it's never a normalizable state. And the normalizable zero mode was supposed to be the whole thing that was responsible for giving you four-dimensional gravity. So this would be a very bizarre result, right? You would say that we would take a limit as the cosmological constant got small, and we would lose gravity. Or if we live in a flat space with four-dimensional gravity, we get some arbitrarily tiny negative energy, and suddenly we lose gravity, which seems a very hard to believe thing. Another thing that sort of clues you in that's actually funny about it is that, of course, as this is going further and further away, and what's going on is that we're actually including the ABS boundary in this case. In the original RS model, it's just a Poincaré patch. In the case of the ABS frame, you actually go all the way to the ABS boundary, which is why it's warp factor 1290. Okay. But you might think, well, this is all local physics, right? If we're getting four-dimensional gravity based on the gravity existing near the brain, being concentrated in the brain, so why should it depend on what's going on infinitely far away or very far away from the boundary? Okay. So those were the puzzles we faced. Right? So are the puzzles there? Okay, so what was the answer? Well, the answer was actually pretty surprising. And it sort of caught people by surprise. It turns out that if you analyze the Kluge-Klein spectrum in this case, you find that there is a mode that is not a zero mode. It's actually a very small mass mode, but not a zero mode. And that actually just exponentially falls and cuts off. And that is what mediates four-dimensional gravity. So there is a mode that has a small mass that mediates four-dimensional gravity. And why was this a surprise? Well, because people thought this was impossible to have a massive graviton mode, because the development of the identical continuity, which says that if you have a massive mode, you're going to have extra polarization states, which means you get disagreement with measures of gravity. For example, if you compare the bending of light compared to other gravitational tests, you would be aware of the but it turns out that wasn't true with ABS space, as long as the mass is sufficiently small compared to the ABS curvature. So this was a surprising result. Right? It turns out, first of all, it's just interesting that because what this is saying is that you really get localized gravity, but it's locally localized. That's to say, if you lived out here, you wouldn't see the four-dimensional gravity that you would see if you lived here, which wasn't true in our original example. And so I think this was a really important example for many reasons. One was, once the string theorists acknowledged that there could be localized gravity, then they said, well, it's nothing other than what they have already. But here you see it's clearly different, because here you have, this is clearly not compactification, because there are some regions where you see four-dimensional gravity, and some regions where you don't, which would never be true in a compact point setting, you have to compactify the same way everywhere. So maybe
So you say it's Helios grid, so you're
saying
you have an Helios grid, you're solving some sort of gravity equations, or just gravity equations for some.
Yeah, there's no supersymmetry here, we're just solving Einstein's equations. And there's a small negative cosmological constant. So the key thing is that it's a small negative cosmological constant. If you have a large negative cosmological constant comparable to the energy in the bulb, you don't have gravity at all. You don't have localized gravity at all. But by tuning a little bit, so basically to get the clock rate in the first place, you have to tune the energy of the brain versus the energy in the bulb. Okay? By detuning slightly, you can get either small positive or small negative energy. So if you detune slightly, and you have a negative energy, you solve the equations consistent with the boundary conditions. And you find that that's what the work factor does. Okay? Yeah?
Since you have a non-zero graviton mass, is your vacuum stable? Do you have force in this one?
No, you don't. I mean, that was so interesting. Was all the standard lore about what would happen if voids were actually based on flat space. And it turns out this model in ADS space is completely. In fact, you know that, I mean, it's basically the fact that we have this higher energy theory from which we could derive it, that is stable, showed that it had to be stable. And then people went ahead after they did this work and explained why, in the case of ADS space, it is stable. And you don't stress. I mean,
is this related to the Riley Capitacci Palladio model?
It isn't, and you see the big difference, which is that we're actually deriving our model from this higher dimensional theory in some sense. So it's just a more natural model. I mean, it's not clear that they actually have a problem with the ghost in their model, but at least when there's only one extra dimension, but it's subtle. So it's not clear whether or not their model is well defined. But here we don't have the problem at all. But people have found ways of sort of thinking about massive gravity more generally, so they can ask these questions out.
What do you think about mass in an ADS background? Or you don't mean the Poincaré?
No, I mean that it's not that mass. So the zero mode, so the one that really has zero mass really has no infinite norm.
But when you identify the mass, you're just looking at an H squared term in the actual time? Or how do you identify what the mass is in the ADS background?
It's whatever would be the thing that travels at the speed of light, essentially.
So it's the conformal state of the mass.
Yeah, that's right. So there were a lot of interesting things to come out of this example, but I mean, I think it shows more the power of localized gravity. I don't think this has been fully exploited yet, that you have locally localized gravity. And I think it could be quite relevant in a cosmological constant where you could imagine really pockets of four-dimensional gravity, just one more dimension here. Okay, so basically the general lesson of localized gravity and locally localized gravity is that the universe can look only as if there are three spatial dimensions, even though there really are infinite extra dimensions. So what I want to ask now is there a reason to single out three dimensions? I mean, you know, both of those models, we put in a free brain. And the question is there a reason we're focusing it on free brains other than the fact that we know that they know? So let me first tell you what's the most popular idea for explaining three dimensions in the context of string theory, which is the Brandenburger-Bobel proposal. Now what they do is they assume compactified dimensions. And so what they say is that all the dimensions start off very small, and only a few grow large. And the ones that can grow large are the ones for which there are the cases when there's no opposing force. And what the opposing force, they think, comes from graph strings. So if you have a compactified dimension and you have graph strings, those would prevent, if there's too many of them, those would prevent the growth of the universe. And that was their idea. So they ask the question, when can you get rid of these graph strings? And the answer is, well, you can't in general unless they can be used as an annihilate. So you can imagine these strings and anti-strings, that's to say strings wound in the opposite direction. They can be an annihilate. However, strings in general won't mean if there are too many dimensions, just because their world has been never crossed, their world sheets have never crossed. So they concluded that there are going to be four or fewer dimensions, so that their world sheets are likely to intersect, and so that they can annihilate. Okay. If there are more dimensions, they would just be ships that pass in the night, and they wouldn't annihilate, and you would have too many of them, and the universe would never expand. Okay.
That middle thing is a statistical argument, but. I mean, it's not impossible for it to be, it's just unlikely if the number of dimensions.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking like infinity versus zero, you know. So it's statistical, but you don't need the full power of statistics to get there. So. Okay. So they can put some of this in their equilibrium dimension. And based on it, the argument 6A is probably 4. Okay? That was their argument in a nutshell. Okay, so it's a good idea, but it was proposed in the 1980s, and physics has advanced since then a little bit. So, but there are some problems with the idea. One is that it depends on poorly understood dynamics at the Planck scale, because you have to assume the construction of physics growth, and I think starts small. That's fine, I mean, it's an assumption, and it's okay. But it also depends on modular stabilization, but more importantly, it depends on simple toroidal compactification. If you had some more complicated compactification, they might not even be wrappings, or they might not be able to find each other. There might be obstructions. So it really is assuming simple toroidal compactification. And I think the biggest objection I've had is that since the 1980s, we know that strings are not the only thing in string theory, that we know there are brains, and it's neglecting these brains. And people have tried to incorporate them, but I don't think they've done them in very interesting ways. So what I want to do is think about four dimensional concepts of brains and localized gravity. And what I want to do is I want to make the opposite assumption that Brandenburg and Bacha made in the following sense. What Brandenburg and Bacha said is, we know what's in string theory, namely strings, one-dimensional extended objects, and we'd like to figure out how many large dimensions there are. We're going to take the opposite perspective here. We're going to say we actually know how many dimensions there are in string theory. And we can debate this, but this is what we're going to assume. We're going to assume that there are non-large or infinite dimensions in string theory. So there's 10 space-time dimensions. And we're going to assume that we know the number of dimensions, and we're going to ask which are the objects that get picked out if there are 10 space-time dimensions. Namely, it's the strings, it's the brains, it's just brains with dimensionality of brains. So that's the question we're going to ask. And if three brains dominate at the end of the day, well, then they seem to be a good candidate for our universe. So that's the basic motivation. That's our basic idea of how we're going to approach this question of dimensionality. So the basic idea is, again, we're going to have a 10-dimensional space time dimensional universe. We're going to let it evolve according to conventional astrophysical cosmology. We're going to assume, we're going to make the most generic assumptions possible, so we're going to assume an equal number of brains and antibrains, which is to really say that brains oriented in random directions. We're going to assume that we have brains of all dimensionality present. We're not going to assume anything is favored. But we're going to let it evolve, and we're going to ask, and we're going to let it evolve just by the energy of the brains themselves. We're not putting anything else in. We're going to find out which is a self-consistent solution, which are the brains that can self-consistently dominate the evolution of the universe, and thereby maximize the energy and maximize the filling fraction of the universe. Do you have a question? Okay. So,
all dimensions non-compact. I mean, they're all infinite.
They can be infinite or large. They just have large enough to accept which we might as well smear. We don't have any questions right now. Other questions at this point about the general idea? So what happens? Well, obviously during the universe's evolution, some brains are going to dominate more than others. And at some time we'll be left in a universe in which certain types of brains dominate, and the assumption we're making is those are the ones that are to be the most likely for us, the ones we're most likely to live. Okay. So I'm going to start and show you what we did. Okay, so we're going to have 10D FRW evolution. Okay. The great thing about doing FRW evolution, I mean, you can question whether FRW evolution is appropriate, but it's basically the only thing we can do. So to get precise to this, and run it in some state of inflation for many years, we don't know. But the great thing about it is once we assume FRW, we have a homogeneous isotropic universe. There's only one function we need to know, which is AFT. Okay, that's the great thing about FRW. So we want to find out what A of T is, and this is in the sigma here is a non-dimensional information section. Okay. So this is kind of fun. I mean, it's actually kind of amazing because it would have been, you see, you know, over 20 years people would have done this kind of thing. Because I mean, after all, people say string theory has 10 dimensions. I mean, we know we don't live in 10 dimensions, but it's kind of fun to know what's going on in 10 dimensions. I mean, a few people have thought about it. But it's just a worthwhile question to ask. Did anything special happen in 10 dimensions? So if this is work out, what happens with the evolution equation? So we have our standard H squared equation, H being A dot over A, A being the scale factor I gave you earlier, so D over T over T, so over A. And it's related to rho. So H squared is proportional to rho, just like it is in the part of the equations you're familiar with before, the space-time dimensions. But we now have dependence on N, N being the number of spatial dimensions, so N is 9 for this analysis. Okay? And also we have the equation of conservation of energy, and you put those together and you can find H2. Okay?
Are you assuming constant equation of state?
Yes, so I'm just about to answer that. Okay, so we're going to do basically what you do when you do 4D evolution. It's not that the equation shape is constant, but it's just that eventually one component is going to dominate. So in any given era, you have either like a radiation-dominated era or matter-dominated era. So there's going to be a single W that dominates, even though there can be more than one component. So there's going to be some intermediate period where both contribute, but we're just looking for the ultimate, basically, attractor, which would be the stable evolution. So we're going to assume that at the end of the day, there's going to be one component W that dominates, and then it's a solid equation. So that's what we're going to care about, is what's happening at the end of the day. So this is all Latham equation related things evolve, and we're just asking what the dynamics drives you towards. So we're going to just assume here that there's a single W that dominates. That is to say, P equals W rho. So it's going to be...
Isn't it the case that we have basically a gas of brains and stuff rather than the usual radiation fluid?
Yes. So we're going to put in the W of brains.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. So I haven't told you what W is yet. I'm just assuming there is a single W. So we're going to take this W rho.
But you're assuming it's fermalized.
Assuming what?
Fermalization.
Yeah, I'm assuming... Well, it's not even... I mean, I'm just assuming that it's homogeneous and isotropic. So P equals W rho. That's all. I mean, there's no temperature in terms of what I'm saying. It's just rho is embodied in whatever the brain has, so there's no real radiation. If there's radiation, it's going to dominate more than the other stuff. Other questions? Okay, so if we just assume P equals W rho, we can just solve this. And we just find a relationship. So we find two things that will be relevant later on. We find how rho depends on the scale factor. Rho goes like a to the minus n times 1 plus w. Okay. Again, n is 9 here, and w is determined by whatever is the component that dominates. And we find that t goes like a to the n over 2 times 1 plus w, which is to say we know what a of t is. Okay. That's what you get when you solve these equations. So now we want to know what the equation state is for brains, because the brains are presumably going to be what dominates. At least one type of brain will dominate at the end of the day, is the assumption. Okay? So let's just figure out the equation state for brains. And again, it's kind of fun because you get to extend what we know about for four dimensions. So how do we find the equation state for strings in four dimensions? Supposed to be a cosmic string. How do we find the equation state there? Well, you say that you have essentially a cosmological constant along the string. So along the string, you have p equals minus w rho. Okay? But in fact, strings are oriented in all possible directions, so you have to average. So the real equation of state in three spatial dimensions is p equals minus rho over 3. Okay? And now we're just going to generalize that same argument to brain. So now we have a d brain with d spatial dimensions, and it's an n spatial dimension. So w is going to be minus d over n, with the symbol of that. Okay? So from this, you can conclude that the scale factor goes like t to the n minus d over 2. Assuming that the brain dominates, but I haven't told you which is the D that dominates at the end of the day. And then it's going to be 9.
But if you're moving around, it's more complicated.
It can be more complicated, and we can, you know, if one can do that. I mean, a lot of that will dilute away faster, and, you know, we're looking at how things evolve. But that actually is going to enter. I'll come back to that point, because it's a good point.
Okay. The picture is you have one dimension brain, it's not a gas of many different dimension brains.
No, it's a gas of many different dimension brains, but there's going to be, at the end of the day, some type of brain is going to win.
So there's a whole bunch of fluids, each has their own W.
Exactly. And then it's going to be, it can only be self-consistently driven to some of them. If you assume that some other one dominated, well, then you're just going to find that it's driven to a point where the other one dominates anyway. So there's only going to be a single cell.
Fred, why can't you have two different dimensionalities in some kind of equilibrium?
So you can, and we're going to see. But, I mean, you could basically, the real thing is that you have only a single W dominant here, right? Because W determines how quickly the various states. So we saw that rho went like a to the minus one over n or something like that. So W determines the dilution rate. So if they have different Ws, they dilute at different rates. So you might end up with two components that have the same W. But that would be the only way in which they could compute at the same time.
But so is it an assumption that one W dominates, or is
no.
it an outcome?
It's an outcome. It's just easier for me to tell you the answer than to go through all the wrong choices and show you that they don't work.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, how's when T equals N?
Say it again?
If T equals N.
We're going to come to that momentarily. I haven't actually gone through this yet. So you're ahead again. Okay. So let's first assume brains are non-interacting and ask what happens. Well, if brains are non-interacting, actually, you don't even need to know A of T, it's obvious. Because the volume of the brains goes like A to the D, the volume of space goes like A to the N, So clearly their density equals like A to the T minus M. And this is a simple statement of the fact that if you have brains that are extended in two dimensions, they only dilute in the dimension that's orthogonal to them. Right? They only dilute in the perpendicular directions of the brain, and there's M minus D of those. Okay, so it's like A to the D minus M. So that would be a very boring answer, because you would just say that the maximum D dominates, right? And in particular, D equals N would be max. And that's exactly what you expect, right? If you have brains that fill up the universe, they dilute, because they just expand the universe. That's what happens if D equals N.
Is this a logical constant?
What's that?
It's basically your brain that fills up.
It would be basically. But, however, that's because we've like left the interactions, right? So let's consider what happens if you have nine brains. Well, if you have nine brains, and anti-nine brains, remember they're current equal numbers, and they're space filling. They overlap everywhere, so they're not going to last for it. So when we put interactions, it's pretty obvious that nine brains are not going to dominate. Okay? So the first thing we observe is that if nine brains is not the answer. Okay? Eight brains is a little trickier, and I'll come back to that if there's questions, but I want to skip over now. It's just trickier. But let's ask about other brains. So D less than eight, and that's what happens. And here's where things become interesting, and we actually see that three brains might because higher dimensional brains always intersect, and we're going to just assume that if they intersect, they're going to annihilate and dissipate their energy, okay, if they can. So let's ask which are the biggest brains that never intersect. Well, the biggest brains that don't intersect would be three brains, because 4 + 4 is less than 10. Okay. So a three brain will never find an anti-three brain, whereas high dimensional brains will find their counterparts. So for us, we're using the fact that 4 plus 4 is less than 10, rather than 2 plus 2 equals 4, which is what we're under with our bodies. Okay. So what happens? Well, what happens is you don't get rid of all of the big brains, because it has to be consistent with causality. So in general, we expect across any given horizon size to have any order of one of the big brains left. Right? So the argument, again, we get to just extrapolate the arguments that's been made for strings and coordinates. The strings intersect. And you might say that you get a scaling solution. So basically there, strings that intersect this Hahn loops and the radiated wave gravitational wave. And we're going to assume similar dynamics for brains. Okay. So you assume the decay processes happen at the maximum rate consistent with causality. That's an assumption, and it should be applied to basic brains. But the idea is that you're going to have a scaling solution. Like before, you say this length of the strain is some number times t being the horizon size. Here we're going to have the bottom of the D brain being some number times T to the D.
Is there any evidence for that? But there is evidence numerically for scaling solutions in streaming.
No, I think it'd be really interesting to do it. But no, there isn't any. I mean, you know, in the extreme cases, it's pretty obvious that nine brains will annihilate. But it's worth doing for cases like four brains.
The crucial thing is streaming, that they actually change partners when they intersect.
They actually what?
They change partners. Well, basically, if they intersect, they kind of, you know, they're real dynamics.
Yeah, that's right.
Again,
it's sort of a topological reason that you know they should. If it is in principle, can, but, and it's worth tracking. It's not so easy though, because brain dynamics just aren't that well understood. So it's not just our family. I mean, you know, but I think I look at this project as like a first step. I think it introduces a lot of interesting questions that people should be exploring anyway. And, you know, it's just, you know, everyone does sort of the same things. You do this project and you realize there's like a zillion things people haven't actually thought carefully about. And that's one of them. So anyway, so the horizon bias is TPN, so the density is not A to the T minus N in the case of these intersecting objects that we're assuming can annihilate, but T to the D minus N because T is the horizon bias. Okay. So we basically have this two-pass system where we have some brains that are A to the D minus N in density, and the bigger brains that are T to the D minus N. And now we want to ask the question, who wins? Okay? Is everyone with me so far? And so I'm just going to tell you the answer. The answer is that three brains dominate. But not only do three brains dominate, seven brains have the same scaling. Okay? So it turns out that W plus minus 1/3 for three brains in nine dimensions. T goes like A over to the N over 2 times 1 plus W. A goes like 2 to 1/3. And so you find that both seven brains and three brains go like 1 over t squared. That's what we find. Okay. And everybody else says it's a faster rate. It's questions about eight brains, we'll come back to them. But aside from that, everyone else does it's a faster rate. And that was kind of a nice result. So everyone got that. Now, this comes back to a point that I lost earlier, which is what about these bending things? Could that be relevant? And so after we did this work, I confess, we should have taken this into account. But we realized that even even non-interaction output can dissipate energy. And the way they could do that is they can start up really kinky. So effectively, they end up with a different dimensionality. So they can start up really kinky, and as those kinks enter the horizon size, they can smooth out and radiate energy. And that would actually could change the equation of state sort of free grains, which are non-interacting, for example. So we were worried that this would actually reduce the density of free grains relative to seven grains. And it's kind of nice, because it wasn't the case. So I had this horrible transparency that because I just started using Techify, and it doesn't look so it's really badly done. So I'll tell you what it actually says. Okay, sorry. So it's kind of helps you make this work better. But anyway, the point is that at the end of the day, what's going to happen is the following. It's quite amazing. The relationship A of T changes. The scale factor is a function of T changes, but both components still go like 1 over T squared. So although it wasn't, W is not equal to minus 1/3 in general, you still have both of the 3 grains and 7 grains going as 1 over T squared. Because the 7 grains, it's obvious they go like 1 over T squared. It's 1 over T to the T minus N. The reason the 3 grains go like T squared is that they dominate. So if you have A dot over A squared proportional to rho, the only consistent solution is rho goes like 1 over T squared. And you can show that in a couple of other ways. You can just plug in both equations, and you find at the end of the day, no matter what, if the 3 grains are dominant, the 7 grains have exactly the same W as the 3 grains. You find W7 is W3. So at the end of the day, independent of the dynamics of 3 grains, as long as 3 grains dominate over everyone else as they will, 3 grains and 7 grains will simultaneously dominate the volume and energy density of the universe. So that was our basic result. That was really good. Okay, so where are we? Well, what I've just shown you, I hope, is that the only stable evolution in this, with these assumptions is 3 grains and 7 grains dominating. And it's kind of a nice result from the point of view of people who like doing string theory, because it turns out not just 3 grains, but 7 grains enter a lot of the time when you try to do phenomenology associated with string theory. 3 grains enter for obvious reasons, but a pile of 3 grains can be a gauge group. But in that case, 7 grains actually act as matter representations of that gauge group. So 3 grains and 7 grains simultaneously occur there. Another place they occur is in cosmology. There's inflationary models based on 3 grains and 7 grains. So it isn't what we were looking for, but it's actually kind of a very interesting result. We still want 3 grains to be there, but the fact that it's 3 grains and 7 grains is kind of interesting.
Do you know whether they coincide, the 3 cooling seconds?
No, so I'm going to come to that now, because I think that's the other direction that there's a lot of interesting questions. So putting in more about the interactions and seeing whether these things will be moves. Like, could there be attractive forces so that they are? There's a lot of interesting questions. So anyway, this is what I just said. So there's one question, though, I haven't addressed yet, which is why we see four-dimensional gravity in this context. Because we understand why we see four-dimensional gauge forces now, because there's lots of three grains. But why should we see four-dimensional gravity? And good seven grains are going to play a big role. So there's a lot of questions remaining about really tying together the piece of the talk we give now to the piece of the talk I just gave. And then I think it's going to be required to really put in three grain, seven grain interactions to understand this better. But I wanted to show you something cute that we found, and this is work I did with Liam Fitzpatrick, subsequent to the first work which I did with Andreas Karch. And what we showed is that you can have the intersection of 3 7 grains and have four-dimensional gravity localized on the intersection. So what this means is you can jump directly from 10 dimensions to 4-dimensional gravity by having the presence of 7 grains. So it's kind of a neat result. So the first observation is that if you have 3 intersecting 7 grains, in general, they're going to intersect over 4 dimensions, right? And I just show that here explicitly. It's going to be 4 with the overlap, and then we're going to assume that they sort of go into pairwise orthogonal directions. Okay? So we're going to now need to assume anti-Poisson space to get localized gravity. So we're going to now assume that they exist in ABS space. The idea is we're going to show that there are various conditions. There are conditions on various tension components so that you get localized gravity, okay, on the four-dimensional intersection. That's what we want to show. Okay. And to do this, what we did is we combined together two ideas. And I should say the first one was an idea I had actually had seen before. So Virgena and Shapashnikov had actually considered codimension 2 localization. So Ron and I did codimension 1. They actually had done clinical samples of codimension 2, and 7 grains and 10 dimensions are codimension 2. So this is going to be relevant to us. Okay. Arcani, Hammond, Demopoulos, Valli, and Caliper considered codimension 1 intersecting grains. And so there's a simple intuition behind what they did, but it's not exactly correct. So I'm going to first tell you a simple intuition, I'm going to tell you why it's not exactly what you're thinking about it. So suppose you had intersecting bricks. So we showed, for example, you go from 5 dimensions to 4 dimensions, right, your localization. Suppose you start off with 10 dimensions and you had an 8-grain. Well, then you should be able to localize and get 9-dimensional gravity. And then once you have 9-dimensional gravity, and if you have an intersection there, you should then be able to go down to 7-dimensional gravity. So if you have enough grains, you should be able to have high codimension and find localized gravity by going step by step. Okay, of course, in this case, each of the tensions would be different, because what you're always doing is tuning a bulk tension against a brain tension. And if you do it iteratively like this, all your brains would be different. And that's one possibility. But what they did was actually something different, where they had all the brains running the same tension. They had them all intersect and had gravity localized just at the intersection. In fact, they didn't do this, but if you go back and ask, what about the tension on all the brains, you find that all the brains were anti-Hasidic brains without a tuned tension, so that gravity is localized solely on the intersection. It's not like you have higher dimensional gravity on any of these brains. You just get one place where you localize gravity, and that's the intersection, and that's where they go. Okay. So those are the two ideas I'm going to combine together. All right. So I just want to say a few words about the group editor Poshnikov setup, because it actually was kind of cute and interesting. So they had a string-like defect in ADS6. And they assumed that the two are, now remember, it's codimension 2 now, but they had two very different directions. They had one which was a radial direction, which I'm calling rho, and they had another which was an angular direction. Why is it angular direction? Because they actually had a periodic boundary condition. Now you might say, why isn't this just compactification? The reason is because the circle could, in principle, have grown arbitrarily big. It's only because of the ADS space that we're going to find that the circle shrinks to small size. So they actually weren't compactifying space-time just based on the circle. The circle could grow arbitrarily large. Mm-hmm. So, and then they also had, actually, the middle component you should assume is zero, but they assume in principle you get three different tension components. So it's not just a cosmological constant over the string that's going to do that. But there are two different tension components. There's one along the linear direction, 0, 3, and there's another along the theta direction, for the that wraps around. The radial point you'd like to set to zero to have energy conserved on the structure. Okay? So they have two different tension components, and that's why they can get this to work. Okay, so that was critical to look at that. Okay. Is that clear?
When did they do this?
I don't remember. It was a while ago. Okay, just don't remember. Okay. Are there other questions? Okay. So this is just to say what's going on with the transverse dimensions. It's just saying the fact that it is a circle. The circle would have grown to infinite size, except for the fact that it's going to be anti-Hasidic space, so everything is going to get warped. There's going to be this exponential factor that shrinks the circle to zero size, even though it's sort of a problem. Okay? That's the idea. So to do this analysis, they want to find the tension relations and see if they can find the distribution with a flat four-dimensional metric. Okay? So they want to solve Einstein's equation. So you have some tension on the string like defect. You have that ADS space in the background, you'd like to solve it. Now, you might be worried about something, because when you have these codimension 2 defects, unlike codimension 1 defects, you're not allowed to take a delta function limit. In fact, you can see from the picture I gave a moment ago why you can't take a delta function limit. Because the ADS space is saying that your overall metric factor is increasing as you go towards the boundary of the string. But if you have this radial direction, this angular direction rather, you know that the metric better go to zero there, to r squared d theta squared, essentially. So it has to grow big and then get smaller. If you had a delta function, then you would have a discontinuity in your metric, and you would have ambiguities in how you would take that limit. So to make it clear, you want to have a thick string. But if you have a thick string, you might worry that your answers are going to depend on the details of that string. The amazing thing was, surprisingly, it didn't really depend on the details. It depended on very little. And the reason for that was when they used Einstein's equations, they found something that we found quite interesting and surprising, and didn't understand until we did our work. They found that although Einstein's equations are second derivative equations, they were able to reorganize things into two first derivative equations. Okay? So they were able to reorganize them. And the derivative of the thing they're taking actually has another derivative. It's still a second derivative equation. But it's done in such a way that you can relate things to what's going on the boundary. Because it's a first derivative equation, you can integrate it and relate it to what's going on in the boundary. Okay. In fact, that's good because the boundary, we know the metric there, it's just matching onto the ADS metric. So that's a very nice piece of the result. But, however, there's also the boundary of what's going on in the interior. So to do this, they actually needed to assume some boundary conditions of what's going on at rho equals zero. So they do have a few constants that their answer does depend on. But aside from that, it's independent of what's going on in the interior, which was quite intriguing. It's quite curious. Okay. And so I'm not going to go through the details, but this just says what I just said. Okay. So at the end of the day, they get two tension relations. Okay. The first tension relation is just a genuine relating of the tension of the different components. This was the new 0-3 one. This was the angular one. And this has to do with what the ABS space is. Okay. The second relation, so you always know you're going to get one that just represents the fact that you have a flat metric, 0 cross multiple components, that's that one. Okay. I'm sorry, actually, I made a mistake here. The interesting thing is it sort of didn't depend on what the ABS curvature was. People thought maybe this is some way of addressing the cosmological constant. I don't think it's true, because once you have a non-flat metric, this isn't true anymore. But you got this interesting tension relation. The second tension relation we did is mu zeta to R0. R0 was the radius, was the size of the circle, of the compactified circle at the boundary of the string. And really, the way to interpret this is just an equation that determines R0. So it's not a tuning condition. It just determines what R0 is. We didn't put that in. Okay? So, but in any case, this is the answer. Okay? And you can solve it because of this. And mu, again, I don't know if I said this, but mu were the integrated tension densities. So you might have, as I said, thought things depended on the details of what's going on in the interior, which would be f of rho, f as a function of radio point of rho. But at the end of the day, the answers only depend on mu and some boundary conditions, which is a very nice result.
But the setup is there's a 3-grain in the middle, and then there's a 4-grain on the outside?
Ann Nelson and somebody else did something like that. And it's really very similar, but that's not, they actually just have a fixed string. You could have done it in that way as well. And you kind of go back and forth between the two. But that's not what these guys are doing. They don't have a four-way. You can think of it for some purposes that, but here they just have a string up to that. Okay. And this is just to say you get localized gravity. Okay, so, but I think the most interesting, just technical, is the fact that they were able to organize things in the first derivative equations, which I'm going to come back to. Now I just want to say a few words about intersection codimension one brings in. I don't want to say a whole lot. Again, you just want to solve Einstein's equations in the presence of all these intersecting grains, which actually are going to, it will soon have the same tension. It turns out it's very nice because it's ADS space, you can solve things. And the other thing that makes it nice is the fact that these are all delta function grains because they're codimension one. So that was the thing that worried us. We were not able to take delta function grains, but we were going to be able to repeat this analysis. Okay? And I don't think any of the details are important. This is just what I said earlier about the grains themselves not localizing gravity, but just gravity on the intersection. So what we want to do is we want to combine together these two ideas. We have intersecting codimension two grains. And we were worried that we wouldn't be able to solve the tension relations because we have these thick grains again. And it's more complicated than just having a thick string, and so we didn't know if we would be able to integrate these equations. But it turns out we could, for a very nice reason. If you have this metric that depends only on the radial component rho, the metric components depend only on rho, it turns out for the directions that are not rho, you have this nice formula for the curvature, the diagonal components of the curvature tensor, RAA. And you'll notice the details here are not important, but you'll notice that it is a derivative of something. So again, it's a derivative of a derivative. It's a second order thing. It involves two derivatives. But it's such that you have a first derivative of some quantity. And that's key, because if you have the first derivative of some quantity, that means that you can integrate the equation and get some nice tension relations. In other words, we can relate the metric to the integrated tensions, which is what we want to do. We don't want to have things depending on the details of the tension. And again, we can use the integral of that, and just like we wanted. We relate things to that. I just want to mention this one point because it was a sort of very interesting point. So essentially what we found is we had a first derivative, so we could actually use Stokes' theorem. So let me just come back to that. If we had a first derivative, R was a first derivative. When we applied Einstein's equations related R to the tension, we could integrate it. So what we had is R was AA was related to the tension. We could integrate that so we can relate mu on the right-hand side to the quantity that's inside the derivative on the left-hand side and evaluate those quantities at the boundary, right? That was the point. And so we had these intersecting grains, and you think that if you just have them evaluated on the exterior of these grains, now the exterior of these grains is matching onto ABS space, so that's something we know and doesn't depend on any of the details of what's going on inside. Now that will be an extremely strange result too, because even in the case of the string defect, we found things depending on the interior. And the reason for this is that its formula breaks down when the metric goes to zero, when you have a singularity. So what we had to do was enclose the center of the singularity of rho equals zero with some surface, And we actually do get interior contribution as well. So we have to be careful when we're applying Stokes theorem. And although you don't think there's interior contribution, there actually is an interior contribution. And you can show that this matches onto the string length result. So this was really kind of nice because we sort of have a more general understanding of why those equations could be integrated when we did this analysis. And of course, I'm not going through the details here, but they're on our paper. So the upshot is that we were able to do that, we were able to find tangent relation, but they did involve these extra components D, which have to do with integrated and defined at the rho equal zero in each of the cases. But we were, again, able to show, in the case of three intersecting semigranes, that we do get gravity localized at the intersection, which is exactly what we wanted. And this is pretty interesting, because now you get everything you want, and it's a nice starting point for cosmology. I mean, it would be very interesting. I mean, now we have this four-dimensional matrix that is just localized on the intersection of seven grams and 10 dimensions. And then you have all sorts of interesting questions, like, does this turn into standard four-dimensional FRIW? Do three grams get attracted there? Could you even get inflation? Because three grams and anti-three grams are being attracted at different rates to the intersection. There's all sorts of, and you can get brain inflation from that scenario. So there's sort of all sorts of interesting questions that arise about how cosmology works. It's very complicated, many possibilities, but there's a lot of ideas that have not yet been explored. And you know, you can even have other scenarios where the three brains are slightly mismatched with the seven brains, and then you get a hierarchy. And there's really all sorts of interesting possibilities. So I'm just going to conclude that I think this is definitely a new way of thinking about cosmology. And it just introduces lots of new and interesting questions. I think the results are interesting, but I think the questions that we didn't answer yet are interesting too. And I think the first part is fairly robust. You have this idea that the evolution three grains and seven grains will dominate. The second part is also robust, that you can get gravity localized at the intersection of seven grains in ADS space, but you really want to merge these two together, and I don't know how smooth that transition will be, like how this is all going to fit together, and there's a lot of interesting cosmological questions there. But I think it's clear that there could be very qualitatively different cosmological scenarios that we're getting here. And also we might have some understanding why three dimensions are special. So I think the dynamical realization principle and localized gravity are just right for further study. Thank you.
I just wondered, I mean, the initial FRW assumptions, how robust is this result to that? I mean, what if
I don't know the answer to that. Right. You know, and this is a simple thing to start with, and it's a good next step. I mean, if I found something that was sensitive to perturbing that, that would be more sensitive. Right, and once it is sensitive. I think it should be fairly sensitive just because it's based on the evolution of a lot of the symbols fade away, but it's worth checking.
One of the criticisms leveled against string theory is that it is background dependent. Can you say something about that?
No.
Regarding your theory?
I mean, it's dependent on all these assumptions. I mean, I'm assuming that we know how to do Einstein's equations. I'm not really assuming string theory, I'm just assuming the assumptions in string theory.
So background dependence is inherent in your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, we're not answering fundamental questions about quantum cosmology. We're still answering fairly abstract questions about cosmology, assuming Einstein's equations are valid. I'm not going up to the quantum gravity. And that's one thing that's nice about this, unlike Brandon River Bottle, we're not looking at Einstein's equations.
What happens to the time evolution of the whole 10-dimensional space? Does that affect somehow the localized gravity?
I think it shouldn't. I think the four-dimensional gravity is dominating and should decouple, but that's research subject. I mean, I'm just saying that. And we really have to see how these fit together. Can you have this four-dimensional universe? So the question I would like to know the answer to is, can you really have 10 dimensions, 9 to spatial dimensions sitting around, but have this cosmological evolution of four dimensions within that? And we show that it's possible in the case of 5 dimensions, right? We know that the four-dimensional evolution, cosmological evolution, really can work at least at late times completely independently of what the 5-dimensional evolution is doing. And so, but that was assuming this global ADS. So this is a question in the case of a cosmologically evolving 9-dimensional space, can we actually have this decoupling? So that's a real question.
This, I think, may be related to Ron and Sabine's question, but I'm just wondering if there's, have you thought about whether this FRW evolution is stable under this dynamics? In other words, you have a...
It's the ADS that worries me, it's not the FRW that worries me. It's the ADS that worries me. And so, I don't know how this is going to work. It could be that the three brains create an ADS locally. You know, we really have to figure out how to get it, because we no longer just have global ADS, because it's really cosmologically evolving. I mean, some more interesting points there, and I don't know how it's all going to work out. That's, if I just kind of wrote it.
Getting back to the issue of cost and stability, which is an ongoing issue in this item. There's a recent paper from Oxford University claiming that PGP does have cost and stability.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd puzzle, I suppose I'd puzzle that when you go from a flat space case, which is cost, to actually consider this sort of the cost disappear.
Well, it has, okay, so, I can explain that. It's not going, in this case, there's no ghost, in the, you know, CGP has ghost potentially. RS does not have ghost, right? So that's the first point. There's more different, more fitting and very conserved in the case of RS. And so you do not have ghosts in that case. And so that's a little less mysterious. I mean, what was used to. But one thing that was mysterious was that you didn't have the BVDZ discontinuity. And you can understand that in part because the kinetic term for the scalar mode that would have caused the problem is getting a large scalar term through the ADS curvature. And because of that, it doesn't have the same problem to work out.
Yes. Suppose we didn't know anything about string theory. Will you use your argument to go backwards and say, well, let's use the experimental fact that we seem to live in 3 plus 1 dimensional object and say, well, using this, we will conclude that we necessarily live in something that at least has 8 plus 1 or 9 plus 1 dimensions?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, the question is, do you think this is the only way we can possibly explain 3 dimensions? Very likely, if it wasn't string theory, there might be other ways.
No, wait, I'm just saying, using the logical possibility that we can imagine a
it's really consistent.
B-dimensional space,
I understand what you're saying.
High-dimensional objects, and yeah. Experimental fact that we're living in a 3 plus 1 dimensional.
It's really true. I mean, the statement I can make with safety is that, had it not been on spatial dimensions, this conclusion would not be true. So it depends how robust you find this whole analysis.
Right.
We can
answer that. 11 would change everything.
11 would change the score grains would be relevant. And you have to worry about, are you looking at string theory at this situation?
So,
which are four grains.
So there is a little bit of the complaint that you had about random variable buffer. That, you know, it's sort of a, not, it's not a duality invariant statement with the dimension is.
Well, I mean, that was a nice complaint about random variable buffer, actually. Because I don't think physics is duality. I think the abstract description of theory is duality invariant. But actually, physics is not duality invariant. It's something that's strongly coupled, so you know it's strongly coupled. So there's one good description in depth, so obviously we're in a machine where 10 dimensions is a better description. I mean, it's dual to an 11-dimensional description, but this whole description would break down because none of the simple evolution.
So you're saying that you're going to weakly couple 10 dimensional.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there's something to comment on the question, but it seems to me you did make the case for this version of a higher dimensional theory versus the compactification, because this gets you out of two big issues. So one of them is the whole issue of the stability of small dimensions, which has been an issue for Plutus from the beginning. And it gets you out of all of the multiplication of theories that come from modular stabilization, because you don't have to stabilize it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you do have different sorts of multiplications, which is sort of goes back to my original point about, you know, landscape was a very restrictive landscape. It's like we can see a small section of the landscape and we can see the entire universe. I mean, there's all these other possibilities. So yeah, that's different. I mean, as for modular stabilization, I think that is right, and I sort of made up my view. What I guess most people would say is that if we were to get this in some supergravity there or some other scenario, there would be different types of moduli that might have to be stabilized at the end. So I don't know how robust that is. It's only true you get around the annoying modular
state positioning
in
cases. What's the effective cosmological constant at the intersections?
Well, we put that in by tuning the tensions.
So it is 2.
Yeah. It's always 2. No one does that. So.
No, well, I just had a simple question. Are you really using the 4 plus 4 is less than 10, or yes, that 3 plus 3 is less than 9?
Were you doing 4 plus 4 less than 9?
In the sense that they always intersect along the time direction, isn't it?
Well, because if you had 4 plus 4 is also less than 9, right?
No, but I'm...
But I'm saying, somebody better check. Basically, what I'm saying is that
they always intersect along the nice section, so it's really 3 plus 3 less than 9.
No, it's not really, because if you look at the space, I mean, just think that geometrically, if you look at the this world sheet, for example, the string zone 3 structure, if you look at the world sheet, the question doesn't intersect another world sheet. So that really is 2 plus 2. It's not 1 plus 1, it's less than 3. It's really 2 plus 2 is 4.
You said there was some subtlety with age playing.
Yeah. Sure.
The point is basically that eight brains would be a problem if they're there. But they're basically the same sort of problem that we have for domain walls in our space. And so the same sorts of moments people do about domain walls in string scenarios and whatever scenarios have to apply here. So if eight brains are there, they will dominate because they will dilute at a less fast rate than seven brains. However, there's many reasons to think that they might not be a problem. I mean, so what do people say about domain walls? And you know, it would be interesting to really go back and study the domain wall literature more and see how robust what we're saying is, or how, you know, what the lessons were there. But you know, for example, eight brains can trap regions of different cosmological functions so that they can inflate. So it could be that the eight brains just dilute away because it would naturally lead to inflation. It could be that eight brains just weren't there in the first place because of, in string theory, we know we either get odd or even dimensional, at least deep brains. If we do, there better be a complex time-hand because you don't want to produce eight brains. So basically, the upshot is that they could be a problem, but they're no worse a problem than domain walls. And somehow we believe that domain walls, for whatever reason, are a problem. So, but it's something to think about.
In your starting configuration, do you have equal numbers of all types of brains and
yes.
the anti-brains?
Yes.
And domain walls aren't a problem in four dimensions because we find ways to get rid of them, right? I mean, if they're there, cosmologically, it's going to be a problem.
That's right. I'm just saying whatever ways we get rid of them there, we're going to find it. I'm just saying that we're in the same boat.
Do you think you'll ever solve the cosmological constant problem with this whole scenario?
Yeah, probably
about 4 years. I like that.
Let's go to the end.